The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
We have seen that D'Oyvart was influenced for a while by neo-Kantian philosophy. He was also influenced, he said, by the phenomenological movement. Then he discovered that he could not synthesize these movements, these philosophical currents, with his basic loyalty, his basic commitment to the scriptures and to Christian thought. And so, as we have seen, he criticized Kantianism, he criticized neo-Kantianism, and we have given a brief outline of his criticisms of these movements. Now we turn to his criticism of the phenomenological movement, more particularly the thought of Edmund Husserl. It is possible, however, in spite of this criticism, to say that D'Oyvart's thought itself was phenomenological. I myself made a statement to this effect in the collection of articles I assembled some years ago under the title Philosophia Reformanda, Critical Reflections on the Philosophy of Hermann D'Oyvart. And I said that because D'Oyvart's position is that of a very broad empiricism. That is to say, that D'Oyvart's philosophy is based upon our experience of the world, the cosmos that God has created, and that he does not then, as we shall see, he does not want then to impose a priori certain structures on that order, because his thinking is empirical, that it is based on our experience of God's world, and because it is broadly empirical, saying that our experience is more than that of our sense experience, his philosophy, in a certain way, can be called phenomenological. When I made that statement, however, I did not mean to imply that D'Oyvart retained influences from Husserl's phenomenology in an uncritical fashion, influences that would disqualify his position as a Christian philosophy. Clearly, the issue of his philosophical method should be discussed as to its own merits. It should not be pushed aside because of the supposed infiltration of ideas from a tainted background. And so, while I admit that in a certain sense the term phenomenological may be applied to D'Oyvart's position, I must point out that the phenomenological movement was one of the chief opponents that Dooyeweerd criticized. He criticized the phenomenology of Edmund Husserl in particular as a very great opponent of a truly Christian commitment. Now let us bring out then some points of comparison and criticism between Dooyeweerd's view and that of phenomenology. In the first place, I speak of the crisis of foundations. Husserl was concerned about the crisis of foundations in the sciences. I have already mentioned that he was very concerned about the phenomenon we call psychologism. He early attempted to provide an alternative to this, to criticize psychologism in a basic fashion and to circumvent it, to get beyond it, to find its origins, and to discover a method that would free us from its clutches. But he was concerned about this, and in view of this, he sought to develop a truly scientific view of philosophy. He sought to get beyond psychologism and other isms by constructing a truly scientific view of philosophy, establishing it truly as a science of the sciences, a scientia scientiarum, a science of the sciences. If we were then to overcome psychologism, if we were then to overcome these isms, it would be then in terms of a philosophy that itself was based on truly scientific foundations. Now, Dooyeweerd himself was concerned about the crisis of foundations in the sciences. He was very concerned about the rash of isms affecting science. Why is it that such positions as psychologism, biologism, historicism, logicism, etc. Why is it that such isms arise? And furthermore, he asked this question. Why is it that each of these positions appears to be defensible in a compelling fashion? And yet, why is it that they mutually cancel one another out? Now, in a sense, Dooyeweerd's philosophy is an attempt to answer these questions about the unfruitful conflict of the various schools of thought, the various isms. A conflict that is evident even within the sphere of science. Well, now, how is it possible, he asked, if science is truly neutral, that we have such basic differences, we encounter such basic differences among those who wish to have autonomous, neutral, critical approaches, who can reason then in a most strict fashion? How is such a thing possible? How is it that we fall into isms if science is truly neutral? Now, in his philosophy, Dooyeweerd attempted to ask and to answer this question and others, and he then attempted to sort out the place of the various sciences. He sought to establish their respective places in the divinely given order of creation. As far as phenomenology was concerned, he knew, he admitted, that the phenomenologist was seeking then to do something quite analogous to what he himself was attempting to do. He was attempting to get past, that is, the phenomenologist was attempting to get past the various isms and to find a point of transcendence from which then he could survey the whole and not fall into one or another partial standpoint. But Dooyeweerd asks, have the phenomenologists truly been able to attain such a standpoint? Granted that they make this attempt to overcome the isms, are they able, by reason of their starting points, are they able truly to overcome the opposition of the various schools and to gain a transcendent standpoint, perhaps a science of the sciences, a philosophy, then that will allow them to rise above these oppositions? The answer that Dooyeweerd gave to this question is no. His criticism, basically, is what the phenomenologist was not able to accomplish what he set out to do, and that not for some accidental reason, but because of the very nature of his starting point. That brings us then to a second point, which has to do with the self-sufficiency of theoretical thought. This criticism of Dooyeweerd has to do with the assumed autonomy of thought, the self-sufficiency of thought as considered by the phenomenologist. He observed that the idea of autonomy was carried through in a most radical fashion in the philosophy of Edmund Husserl. And so, as I commented a few moments ago, Dooyeweerd considered this philosophy to be one of the most dangerous opponents of a Christian position, of a Christian philosophy. Now, indeed, according to him, it is fundamentally no different with the newer trends in phenomenology, trends which have rejected the rationalistic position of Husserl and have moved in what is most often called an existentialistic direction. Various thinkers, as we are aware, have denied the possibility of neutral, self-sufficient method. It is impossible, they say, to eliminate the existence of the theorist. It's impossible simply to eliminate his worldview. It's impossible then to eliminate everything which might, in the broad sense, be called a value judgment, even though that in any phenomenological position is a problematic word. It's impossible to eliminate such things in a theoretical phenomenological reduction. Now, we know that this existential thinking lies in the sphere of influence of Soren Kierkegaard, among others. It then is reflected in the thought of Martin Heidegger. Thought, as Heidegger has understood it, depends on the existence of the thinker. In fact, as we know, this kind of phenomenology starts out from an analysis of our experience in, we might say, istificient mode. Our experience, as that then is dominated by an objectifying, by a generalizing kind of thought. And it seeks then to penetrate beyond this and to get at, by way of a phenomenological analysis, to get at the authentic existence. Well, Dooyeweerd will say this: yes, indeed, I know that there are such thinkers, but nevertheless, they have not been able to overcome the basic autonomy idea as that exists in a Husserl, as that exists within the rationalistic phenomenological school. And so, no more than Husserl are they able truly to get behind the level of theory to that which is pre-theory, to get beyond what is, in essence, a projection of a theoretical attitude of thought. They are also unable to attain a true transcendent standpoint from which they are able to eliminate the isms in philosophy. Now, as we observed, Husserl, indeed, was very concerned to erect a neutral method. He set the world as a whole in opposition to a transcendental consciousness, which, he said, was constantly going out to the world in an intentional relationship. It was directed to the world. It was going out to the world. It intended the world. It was directed to the world in an intentional relationship. By way of his method of reduction, he thought he could bring to awareness a pure field of phenomena which opened up to transcendental consciousness without any admixture of existent judgments, worldviews, etc. Now, on the surface, at least, we know the existential phenomenologists have not followed Husserl in this respect. Nevertheless, have they truly overcome the problems within his philosophy? Now, they too, as Dooyeweerd claimed, they have not escaped absolutizing theoretical thought. They have not truly understood thought in its religious determination. For them, theoretical thought is still neutral, completely so, and that this is the case is an important consideration, one that cannot be further explored at this point, but one that certainly must be kept in mind. What I'm saying is this, that Dooyeweerd reacted against phenomenology in all of its currents, in all of its directions, both rationalistic and irrationalistic. Against Husserl, he urged that Husserl's transcendental consciousness is no more than a theoretical abstraction. As we saw, Dooyeweerd also criticized Immanuel Kant on this score. We find the same type of criticism in his critique of neo-Kantianism. But here again, Dooyeweerd moves in the same direction. The transcendental consciousness of a Husserl is, in the final analysis, no more than a theoretical abstraction. Dooyeweerd said that it is the concrete self that thinks. A self that expresses itself in the various aspects of reality. If we are going to understand this, of course, we must hark back to what we said about the heart, that it is the heart which provides then the focal point for all of our experiencing, that, as Kuiper said, all the rays of our lives. A focus, they come to a focus, and that focusing is the human heart. And so man is in his relationship to God, and he is then either for God or he is against God at all times. According to Dooyeweerd, Husserl and the other phenomenologists are unable to reflect adequately on the self in its relationship to the true transcendence standpoint. And therefore, they too are unable to obtain a true point of transcendence, and the self which they present is no more than a theoretical abstraction. The self to which they refer is actually a projection instead of a true transcendent standpoint. Now, Dooyeweerd said that all of thought rests on religious presuppositions. It is then only by unmasking the religious presuppositions that lie behind any philosophy that we can understand it in its true proportions. And this is then quite necessary. This kind of critique is very necessary if we are to foster true communication. Well, there is a third point which we must bring under consideration, and that has to do with the primary field of consciousness, the original or primary field of consciousness. Now, as we have seen, there has been an attempt by way of phenomenological method to open up a level that is elevated above such oppositions as form and content, subject and object. There is supposed to be a quote-unquote level that is prior to such oppositions. And this level, according to the phenomenologist, is supposed to be a primary datum, something that is simply given, fundamentally given, which itself is not dependent upon our knowing activity. As we have seen, phenomenology has claimed that everything, the world, is made a pure phenomenon, and that this field of phenomenon is set over against the self in an intentional relationship. Now, Dooyeweerd objects precisely at this point. He says, what is given, what is basically given within our experience is not a field of phenomena that is set up in an intentional relationship to a transcendental consciousness. He indeed objects to the idea that every act of consciousness, even our feelings, is intentional, that it is related to what he calls a Gegenstand, using the German word, Gegen simply meaning against, Stand, well, you might say standing, as something that simply stands against or opposite something else. He says it is simply not true that every act of consciousness, even our feelings, is intentional, related then to a Gegenstand. Instead, what is given within our experience then is a cosmic coherence of meaning in which the self, you might say, in which the human acting self in all of its functions is embedded. It doesn't stand over against it. We cannot think of ourselves then in terms of a transcendental consciousness. Rather, in our functions, in our activities, we are embedded in a cosmic coherence of meaning. Well, the phenomenologist, on the other hand, as we have pointed out, says that the given is over against this transcendental consciousness. It is a field for investigation, which then is free from any and all presuppositions. And as I say, Dooyeweerd demurs. He says that this is not a proper description of the nature of our experience. According to Dooyeweerd, if we think in terms of the theoretical attitude of thought, indeed we have an antithesis present. He describes, as we shall see further, the theoretical attitude of thought is setting up of the logical aspect of our thinking over against a non-logical aspect of reality. But he says, such a relationship, and he is ready to call this indeed an intentional relationship, such an intentional relationship is possible only because of the coherence of meaning which is open to us on the level of our naive experience. That in our naive experience, we have then a direct awareness of reality in its various sides. But in this, we do not then consciously, we do not explicitly set up the one side of reality over against the other. Instead, our relationship, instead of being thought of as antithetic, that we are involved in an antithesis or an antithetical relationship, our relationship to this coherence of meaning may be regarded as enstatic, E-N-S-T-A-T-I-C, that we then are actually involved in, we are set within reality, and that this bond with reality then is quite necessary for what we are doing. We are sort of living with this order which is in the cosmos, without setting one aspect of it over against the other. And even when a particular aspect of thought is analyzed in the antithetic relationship, it resists, Doiver says, inclusion in the theoretical concept because it still has its unbreakable connection with the other aspects of experience. And so, I have already mentioned that both Vollenhoven and Doivert, from the very beginning of their discussions of the theoretical attitude of thought, said that in the theoretical concept that there is not only the logical side, but there is also a non-logical side to it. And so that in a logical concept, there is already a synthesis of the logical and the a-logical. The logical on the one hand, and that which is not of the nature of logical on the other. It is impossible, then, to embrace reality, Doivert said, and so Vollenhoven said, completely in a theoretical concept. As we then experience reality in its concreteness, we experience then the concrete, individual things, events, persons. We experience in the most concrete way, and as we say, we do not analyze theoretically it within this, setting up one thing over against the other. We are, as it were, in something in which we are embedded. And so, Doivert says, our stance vis-a-vis the world in general, in our naive approach to the world. And as we said, when he talks about naive, he does not mean to denigrate this experience at all. It merely refers then to its pre-theoretical character. If we think then of our stance vis-a-vis the world in general, in our naive experiencing, our relationship is not characterized by an intentional going out toward. There's not an intentional relationship. This intentional relationship is characteristic of the antithetic relationship of theoretical thought. It is, then, it stands in sharp contrast to the nature of involvement in naive experience. But this theory, even though it stands in contrast to our naive experience, this theoretical thinking is important. It has its place. The abstraction, which is characteristic of it, is indispensable to science, for example. But this theoretical thought, this setting up of the logical aspect of our thinking over against the non-logical aspect of reality, is indeed possible because the self is not the transcendental consciousness, as a Kant or perhaps a neo-Kantian or as a Husserl thought of it, but is the self involved in the fullness of reality. It is involved with the concrete things and events, persons in the world, and our theoretical thinking is never able to eliminate this pre-theoretical experiencing, nor is it able to ignore it. It does not exist. It does not stand apart from it. It is indeed different. The structure of it is different from that of our naive experiencing, to be sure. But it does not stand apart from it, from this naive experiencing, nor is it possible without it. Indeed, any theory which ignores these primary data of our experiencing, according to Dooyeweerd, is in deep trouble. Now, that Dooyeweerd said that there is a level of naive experience does not mean that he attributes to this naive experience the kind of unity that Husserl sought to find and that others phenomenologists have sought to find beyond the level of theory. They attempt to eliminate the splits and then to find then the level or the field of pure consciousness. Because Dooyeweerd says that within our naive experiencing, we still have the relationship of subject and object. And one of the major contributions, I believe, that the cosmonomic idea philosophy has made to philosophical theory is the idea that there is indeed a subject-object relationship within our naive experiencing, and that this subject-object relationship must be distinguished from the antithetic relationship, from the Gegenstand relationship that is then characteristic of theoretical thinking. Some, as we shall see much later, have challenged this notion, but I stick by my guns and I say that I believe that this is a major contribution of Vollenhoven and Dooyeweerd to philosophy. What does one mean by this subject-object relationship? I've referred to it before, and I have also given some idea of what it means. Let me, however, review a couple of things at this point. The idea, then, is that we, let's say, as we act, as one, for example, paints a picture, takes a photograph, as one gives a lecture, as one sits listening to a lecture, or whatever it may be, that he is doing something. He is doing something then as a concrete self in a particular situation. He is functioning as a subject. But within the context of his functioning as a subject, there are various things that have an object function, that indeed in this situation have an object function. Now, according to Dooyeweerd, in most general sense, an object is characterized by the fact that it is for a subject. Let us take the example of the lecture. There are various things that support the lecturer, in a very literal sense, to almost make a pun in the situation, he's supported by the chair in which he is sitting. Or perhaps he is lecturing from a lectern, perhaps even leaning upon the lectern in order to address the students. Both the chair, or if he is standing, the lectern, function then as objects. They have an object function within the situation. They are not then characterized. They themselves do not act. But they act, you might say, if they act at all, they act as vehicles. They helped in the situation to carry things along. They act as vehicles in the lecture situation. The student may very well have a notebook. He may very well have a pen, most likely a pen or perhaps a pencil, and he is taking notes. His pen, his pencil, his notebook, the chair in which he is sitting, none of them acts of itself. He is doing the acting, but they function, you might say, in an object relationship. They are vehicles in this learning situation. Think just a moment of the social situation in one's home. A guest comes in to the room. One takes his coat and puts it in the closet neatly on a hanger as a sign of respect and as in a helpful way. And one conducts the guest and offers him a chair. Well, in the social situation, it is the host and the guest who are doing the acting, but nevertheless, the coat hanger, the closet, the chair, all have object functions. They're characterized by their supporting role in this situation. They have their being then in relationship to, for the subject. We can think a little further about this, though we shall return to this kind of thing later, that the very arrangement of the chairs in a living room is so calculated as to induce social intercourse, conversation, small talk, as we say, to help everyone when the coffee or tea or other beverage, let us say, or perhaps some cookies or whatever it may be, are served. Sometimes one goes to the closet and gets out these little trays on racks and opens them up and sets them down so that things may be enjoyed in a easy way, in a full way. And all these things then have object functions. They serve as objects within the social situation. Now Dooivaert says that this subject-object relationship does not come into being in the antithetic relationship of thought. Furthermore, it cannot be gotten out of the way by any analysis theoretically. In fact, our theoretical thought will be dependent upon this subject-object relationship, which then is embedded in reality as God has given to us, and which we observe then in our naive experiencing. And our relationship to these things is not really made much into a problem. It can become a practical problem if someone pushes over inadvertently a chair or spills some coffee or whatever it may be. There can be practical problems that arise, but they all arise within the arrangement that is characterized by the subject-object relationship. Sometimes we can become very attached to the objects around us, and so that we do not even notice them. One time I was going downtown to Philadelphia, and I had left my briefcase behind at home. And getting off the train, I was so used to checking as to whether I'd left my briefcase on the train or not, that I was really startled to find that I did not have the briefcase in my hand. I thought then immediately of going back into the train to search for it, but then I remembered, to my comfort, that I had indeed left it home and that I had not foolishly left it on the train. We become attached, we become so used to things which function in the subject-object relationship that we do not then make them into a problem. In the theoretical attitude of thought, on the contrary, what we are faced with in the theoretical situation, we are indeed faced with something over against us which constitutes a theoretical problem. And so Dooivaert would say, no, you may not do this. You may then not seek to eliminate all such things. Some of these things you seek to eliminate so as the subject-object relationship cannot be eliminated. Indeed, you would undermine the very possibility of theoretical thought if you should succeed. Now, Dooyeweerd indeed, however, criticizes some of the basic dualisms that phenomenology has wanted to leave behind. They have tried to overcome a Kantian distinction, Kantian opposition of form and matter. As we have seen, of course, Kant thought that the logical forms of our experience were set up over against or had to be synthesized then with the material of sense. You have the form on the one hand and the material on the other. Your phenomenologists will seek to overcome a form-matter opposition. Whether he succeeds or not is another question. And Dooyeweerd indeed says that we must overcome this kind of thing. However, Dooyeweerd would criticize phenomenology for having set up matters in such a way that they think they must eliminate some oppositions, some distinctions that indeed are embedded in our naive experience and that cannot at all be eliminated. Now, I mentioned just a few moments ago that there was a transition from the rational phenomenology of a Husserl to irrational phenomenology. Dooyeweerd indeed uses these terms. He calls the phenomenological position of Husserl rationalistic, and he calls the positions such as that of a Heidegger or Jean-Paul Sartre in his early writings, he calls that irrational phenomenology. As we said, Husserl sought to enter into a description of the pure phenomenon as to its essence. Later phenomenologists would depart from the attempt to describe a quiescent essence, and they sought then to discover a way to a deeper ontological level by way of analysis of irrational moods. Heidegger entered into an analysis of the mood, for example, of care, Sorge, and anxiety, Angst. Karl Jaspers, applied a method of phenomenological description to an analysis of possible worldviews in his Psychology of Worldviews. Sartre early analyzed the emotion of nausea, in which then the world appeared to us as overwhelming, de trop, as the French would say, just too much, an overwhelming thing. And they all try to analyze these irrational experiences and to get beneath them to uncover an ontological, quote unquote, level of reality. Now, we say that the existential phenomenologists sought to go beyond Husserl in his analysis. Typically, existential thinking has claimed that the phenomenon of the rational phenomenologist is too narrow and abstract. And so Heidegger, as we have suggested, denied that one could bracket the existence of one, the one who thinks. They have said that one's thought is controlled by the way he exists, either authentically or inauthentically. This theme recurs again and again in existentialism. But as we have said, Dooyeweerd wants to go deeper. He says, indeed, that when the irrational phenomenologist has attempted then to qualify, when he attempted to relativize the pure field of phenomena as Husserl tried to find it, When it is tried then to avoid bracketing the existence by eliminating then all existence statements by a phenomenological reduction, that it too has fallen prey to a fundamentally autonomous, self-sufficient method, and then it too has failed to gain a true point of transcendence. But we shall seek to illustrate this point at a later time.